Hi, buddy, I'm Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. Be alive and sober, and it's customary where I come from to let you know that I have a home group. It's called the Design for Living Group on the Jersey Shore. I have a sponsor. I have a server sponsor. Apparently, I need a lot of adult supervision. sponsor a lot of guys, and most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. Yeah. So... Let me lean down. My back is killing me. So we'll do the best I can. I'm sorry I'm tall. All right, there we go. So just to give you a little visual where I come from, I'm 60 miles south of New York City. We live on the ocean on the Jersey Shore. The locals like to call it the Irish Riviera. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous like to call it cirrhosis by the sea. Great place to live. We love it down there. And I just want to thank Nikki for the invite, the committee, the great job they did. If everything looks easy, it's because of the hard work that goes on the committee work. And I'd like to thank somebody we haven't thanked, and it's a very important person here, and that's our ASL interpreters. Yeah. Accessibility is very important here. We know that, and it's really important that everyone has a fair shake when they come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to also thank my host. I just met him. Like 10 minutes. He's been wonderful, but he's a great coffee chair. I know he had a lot of complaints about the coffee, but I saw Spencer Thursday, and he comes up to me. This always happens, you know. He comes up to me and goes, you're from Jersey, huh? I said, yeah. He goes, you know any gangsters? Like Tony Soprano. I'm like, Spencer, that's a TV character. I'm from the Jersey Shore. I know real people like Snooki, Jay Wild. Now, if you're over 40, you might have to lean into somebody and ask about that. And this is my second time in my life in Maine. I was here in 2009 at a thing called NARASA, Northeast Regional AA Service Assembly. It was in Portland, Maine. If you get into service, you're going to find out there's a term we used. Be ready to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your life. And I'll never forget this. It was February, obviously. NARASA's in February. And there was a plane crash the week before. Some of you guys might remember. It was a plane crash in Buffalo, New York. And that day, that Friday, we were coming up here, and it was the exact same plane that crashed. So I had a little bit of nervousness going on, right? And there was 50-mile-an-hour winds at a Newark airport, and I really thought I was going to die that day. It was the worst flight I've ever been on. And I remember there was a general service trustee on the same plane. And in my mind, I said, if this guy, if he's just, he flies a lot, if he's just there looking calm, I'll be calm. Well, this guy had a death grip on his seat. And I never kissed the ground at an airport before, but I did in Portland, Maine, you know. And I remember you guys had 22 inches of snow that Sunday, so we got out of here. So that's my only time in Maine, and here I am with my beautiful wife, Mary Beth. And again, this is what an honor and privilege to be here. I always like to start by letting you know that I was born perfect, and I was quickly handed over to these two character defects called Mom and Dad. And I say that lovingly today. But see, I suffer from a lot of delusions, and nothing's my fault, right? And so it was very apparent that my parents were the problem all the way, right? And all my parents ever tried to do for me was to give me morals, values, a good education. And what I did was I introduced my parents to a way of life that they never knew existed. And little did my parents know, I'm 65 years old, little did my parents know when they crossed me over the threshold at our home and where I lived in northern New Jersey, just 7 miles west, and 20 years earlier, at an address of 17 William Street, Newark, New Jersey, on the sixth floor of a building in an office called Honors Dealers, there was two gentlemen in there writing a book. One's man was named Bill W. The other one was Hank P. And what would happen for the fourth child of these parents would be that I would find a way of life that my parents always wanted for me through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am so grateful for what we have here. I grew up, thank you. I met Mike. He was the archivist here. I hope you guys had a chance to go up there. Our history is so important, and I hope you new guys, and I'm glad you new guys are here, but, you know, get to learn our history, the importance. So here I am. I'm growing up in northern New Jersey. I'm growing up in a real tough neighborhood. I grew up at a time when it was the early 60s. Neighborhoods were segregated by nationality. There was the Italian neighborhood, there was the Irish, there was the Polish, African-American, the Spanish neighborhood, and it was real tough where I grew up, you know. And I grew up in a neighborhood where the only requirement for membership was five or more kids. It was a time when it was really tough. You know, everyone, all the dads worked, all the moms stayed home. You know, it was, nobody was I never saw a father or someone leave their house in a jacket and tie. Everyone was a union worker. Everyone was a cop. Everyone was a fireman. And, you know, it was just a tough, tough neighborhood. I didn't think anything existed out of my neighborhood, you know, but I grew up in this neighborhood, and with all these parties, with all these things going on, there was always an event going on, you know, whether it was a birthday or christening or whatever, a graduation, there was always seeing one thing common at every occasion, and that was King alcohol. And from a young age, this disease of perception that I suffer from, and I believe a lot of you suffer from in this room today, the way I saw alcohol was, this deal is going to be a good deal when I do it one day. Because I would watch the old men in the neighborhood, I would watch my father, my brothers, and I'd see the fun, I see the freedom, I see the wearing life like a loose garment when they got some drinks in them, and I would watch this, and I would just say, I can't wait to do this stuff. Now, don't let me fool you. This was in Shangri-La where I was growing up. I grew up with this guy called Dad. He's cunning, he's baffling, he's powerful. My dad's a real tough guy. My dad's from that generation. You know, there was a lot of guys that came from the Korean War and World War II. They would be like 95, 98 years old around that late. And there was no lovey-dovey in my home. There was no, my dad didn't come up and tell you he loved me or, you know, put his arms around me. There was no fireside chats in my house about the birds and the bees. My dad was a great provider, but my dad was a really tough guy, you know. But what I would witness at a young age, 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, is the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking that first drink. Because what would happen is my dad would come home every night at 5 o'clock and my mom would make these two pitchers, one called martinis, the other one called Manhattans. And what I would witness at that young age is what would happen when someone would take that first drink. And my dad would take that drink and he'd become a different person. He became the fun dad. He became the guy that wanted to tell a few jokes. Sometimes he took me in the backyard and had a catch with the ball. You know, he just became different. Don't let me fool you. There were those days. And these days might have happened in your house, but they happened in my house a lot. Those days when my dad would take that first drink. But then all of a sudden, the plates would be flying across the kitchen. Kitchen chairs would be flying across the kitchen. If you grabbed one of us young kids, we'd be flying across the kitchen. So from an early age, I had a lot of fear for my father. I had a lot of insecurity. And more importantly, I had a lot of secrets. Because you see, I grew up at a time in a family, in a neighborhood that nothing gets shared outside the house. So from an early age, you learn how to internalize your emotions. You learn how to push this stuff down. You learn how to walk around like a walking time bomb, not knowing how to talk about this stuff, because you never go up to your friends and just say, hey, this is what went on in my house last night. My dad was violent. He was beating us. He was doing all these things. You know, me and my two brothers and my two sisters would be under the covers. We would just wait for the tornado to blow through the house and just pray that nothing gets hurt or no one gets hurt in my house. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. So here I am, I'm 13 years old. I'm with five guys that I know to this day. 52 years ago, that's a long time ago. And I'm in a cemetery. I'm 13 years old. Now I believe there's a time when we all have that moment in our lives where things take a shift. And it could be a little thing, it could be a big thing. And I think maybe this is the little thing that happened to me. When I was in fifth grade, my parents wanted a better life for me. Now I'm feeling, you know, the way I was just telling you how I felt. And I was comfortable with the people I was growing up with. But all of a sudden, my parents made a decision to pull me out of the public school system and put me into a Catholic school system where I knew nobody. And it was bad enough that I had insecurities and fear and all this other stuff that was going on inside me. But that was the moment that, man, I felt like a square peg in a round hole. I didn't know anyone. And then I was introduced to Catholicism. I was introduced to these things called nuns. I don't know if anyone ever dealt with them. They're a cunning, baffling, and powerful group themselves. You know? And this is the time when some of you older guys remember, this is when you had the old 15-inch metal ruler, put your hand down, clench your eyes, right? Because they would whack you, right? But that doesn't make me alcoholic. But on this particular day, I'm with these new kids, new friends, new neighborhood, new school, and we're in the cemetery. I'm 13 years old. And here comes that first bottle. It's called Colt 45 malt liquor. And I put my hand in there with a lot of fear because I see what alcohol is doing to my family, right? Here comes that second bottle. It's Mohawk Blackberry Brandy. And I start drinking on that blackberry brandy. And what I can tell you about my first night drinking is that I puked purple for 2 weeks. I took a beating from my father. My mother grounded me for life. But the hook was in. I found the magic elixir, the thing that made that thing just quiet down inside of me. That thing that just works for guys like us and girls like us until it doesn't. And here I was, 13 years old, and I didn't get on, you know, I didn't get on the streets and start playing and doing all that stuff with that I eventually did. But boy, did I find the answer to my problem. And I don't even know who that was until I landed in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, growing up in this neighborhood, I'm a street guy. You know, I grew up in that time when your parents would open the door at 8 o'clock in the morning and boot you out the door. They knew you'd come back at some point, you know. But I became a little street guy at the time. I became a little wannabe gangster. I wanted to be a thief. I wanted to, you know, I started to pick up all the things that we do on the street. You know, my dad wasn't my idol. My brothers weren't my idol. You know, my idol became the neighborhood bookie. You know, he had a nice Cadillac. He had a car. He had a wad of cash all the time in his pocket. He had the broccoli elastic band around the cash. That's someone I want to inspire to be like, right? And, you know, I'm not too bright. My friends are not too bright. As a matter of fact, if you drove in my neighborhood and you saw me standing on a corner with my friends, you would say, hey, Jimmy, there's a dead bird. And I would look up. I'm not too bright, right? But here I am. I'm drinking already at the age of 13 years old. And by the time I'm 18 years old, I'm an everyday drunk. By the time I'm 18 years old, the alcoholic life seems the normal one. Doesn't everyone leave for a softball game on Tuesday and come home on Saturday in the same uniform? Like a little league or walking home, because I didn't understand something that I had to learn from you guys, and that's the first drink, get you loaded. That's the first drink, get you loaded. I thought that was the stupidest thing I ever heard when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. How can it be the first drink? I think it's the last 20, outside issues, all that other stuff. I have no idea that this thing is getting to me after I take that first drink. I have no idea about this allergy we talk about in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and in our literature. I have no idea that I have a mind that doesn't shut up. I have no idea about this stuff. So I take that first drink and off to the races I go. You know, I go to a Jesuit prep school. My parents always wanted a good education for me. I go to this high school, and all I can tell you about high school is I'm drinking around the clock in high school. And if my mother wasn't the secretary to the principal, I would have got thrown out a long time ago. But two things happened in high school I like to share. I'm not really proud of what I'm going to share, but this is what went on. One was the morning drink. I was a basketball player. I was playing in a big basketball tournament, and I was drunk the night before. And what happened was I got on the bus the next day with one of my teammates, and he opened up a bottle that he had in his gym bag. And he goes, if you take this drink, you're going to feel better. And all of a sudden, I started to learn about it. If you have shaky hands, you have those DTs, you have those tremors that are going on, a couple of drinks, a couple of pops, all of a sudden, you feel better. So by the age of 18, I'm taking that morning drink just to calm my nerves down. But more importantly, one day I'm in a school and I'm kind of debating a priest, a Jesuit. And he comes out and he throws me out of his class. I didn't understand why, because it's the great me. Why would you throw a guy like me out of your class, right? And when he comes back out to talk to me, I grab this priest and I knock this priest out. I didn't go to hell yet, don't worry. And I only tell that story, and that's an embarrassing story. I mean, who wants to hit a priest, right? But I earmarked that spot, 17 years old, drinking all the time. I earmarked that spot because from that point to the point I got into AA and even a few years in AA, I always got angry at it or I always drank at it. That's when I became my old man. I either got angry at you or I drank at you. And that was the only way I knew how to face any kind of conflict, any kind of social scene, any kind of anything. I got angry at it. Or I drank at it. So on to, through my life, and I'm not going to bore you with a drunken log. You know, I went on to the greatest 10 years of my life. Most people call that college. It was But the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm drinking around the clock, and like Fran, our Al-Anon speaker the other day, she talked about, you know, getting tossed out of college. I got tossed out of college. I went with 9 friends from the neighborhood to the mountains of Pennsylvania, and it was like the old movie Animal House. I didn't have a prayer, you know. Every day was just one party after another. Never went to class. So I come back to New Jersey, and what's a guy to do? I have no education. I got no trade. I got no hook to get into a union job. So this really just starts my career as a 18, 19, 20-year-old kid. There's a bar on every corner where I lived. I would just go down to the corner bar and let's figure it out. Let's just figure this out. What am I going to do? And once in a while, I'd get a job here. Once in a while, I'd get a job there. But every morning, you know, I was down at that corner bar trying to figure it out. And don't get me wrong. I don't think I'm an alky at the time. I don't even think drinking's a problem. I got the same goals, aspirations, and dreams that everyone in this room had at one point. I just don't know how to attain them because I keep on taking that first drink. So here I am. I'm 18 years old, 19 years old. You know, getting in a lot of trouble. I thought I'd go back to school. I didn't really want to go to real school, so I went to bartender school, you know, and well, I really became a mixologist. I got the diploma that shows it, you know, and that just started the career of bartending at, you know, clubs and stuff of that nature, and that I don't even have to tell you about that story. That was just ridiculous. Seemed like everyone was moving on in life at one point. Seemed like my friends were starting to move on. Seemed like they were getting careers. It seemed like they were getting, you know, a nice girl. It seemed like they were getting engaged and getting married, and I wanted all that stuff. I didn't know how to pull that stuff off. And by the time I'm 25 years old, you know, I'm the double-edged sword guy. I'm living under the delusion that the way I feel and why I feel the way I feel is because of everything that you've done. See, I'm a great blamer. I live a life in grievance. I take everything personal. I blame everyone. I listen to the chattering of my mind. I think I have control of outcomes. I think I'm the director of life, but I'm miserable. I'm an alcoholic. And worst part is I don't even know that. And here I am, I'm 25 years old, double-edged sword guy, blaming everyone on one side of me for everything that's going on in my life. And the other side of me is, you know, always searching, seeking something out there to make myself feel better in here. And whether it's drink, drugs, women, cars, money, you name it, anything of material value, I think that's the answer to my problems. So at the age of 27 years old, I make a decision to get married because that's what I think is going to fix me. Another delusion. And I get married at 27 years old. And see, the problem with getting married at the age of 27 years old to a woman who really didn't know what she was up against or what she was going to start seeing and going on is that I had the inability not to take that first drink. I have no idea that I have a mind that does not shut off. I have no idea when my mind says drink, I drink. I had no idea once I take that drink, I light a fuse and I'm off for the races. So at the age of 25 years old, I get married to this woman. What happens is 40 days into the marriage, I walk out of the marriage because drinking's more important than being a married man. See, I don't know how to be a loving man. I don't know how to be responsible. I don't know how to be caring. I don't know how to take care of other people. I'm selfish, self-centered to the max. I don't think anything's my fault. It's a real bad formula for a healthy relationship. I have no idea about intimacy. I think intimacy is sex. I have no idea it's about trust and affection and love and all that stuff that we talk about. And so I take off of Florida because that's the only place I know to go because I have friends that live in Boca Raton, Florida. They have a beautiful condo on the beach. I'm waking up every day. I get that knock at the door like we all do. It's the four horsemen of terror, frustration, bewilderment, and shame. Somewhere along the line, you know, God cracked my skull open and put a chalkboard in my head. And on that chalkboard, there was these three emotions of shame, guilt, and remorse. And it seemed to me at this point in my life that every time I did something, it resulted in one of those actions. The shame of being not a good son, the shame of failing out of school, the shame. You know, Alki's got shame-based identities. The guilt of all the things I was doing. I was getting locked up a lot. I was a little thief. I was doing all the things I wasn't taught to do. My mom and my dad never sat me down and said, this is how you rob a house. This is how you rob a car. You know, that wasn't happening. But here I am. I'm down in Florida, and I'm drinking. I still have a solution. It's called Johnny Walker Red. And I'm at this point in my drinking where I just need to crack the seal of that bottle. And I don't even need to take that first drink because once I take that first drink, I know that grandiosity is coming back. And when that grandiosity comes back, you know what happens. I become that little kid again, that little baby, the perfect little kid that it's all your fault. It's her fault. It's their fault. Always pointing fingers out to the people who I could blame. What a convenient way to live a life. Well, when I come back to New Jersey after a little while down there, you know, I'm ashamed of what I've done. I'm ashamed of walking out of a marriage and leaving this woman basically at the altar. I'm ashamed of what my family thinks of me, my friends think of me and everything. So I make a decision. It wasn't a very good decision, but I make a decision to live on the streets. I didn't want to face the music, so I decided to live on the streets. And for the next 19 months of my life, I lived homeless on the streets of northern New Jersey and lower Manhattan. And let's talk about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, dehumanizing, degradation, just the life of living on the streets. As my old sponsor would say, one night on the streets is one night too many. If you're sitting here and you've had that experience, you know what I'm talking about. Walking the streets. The lonely walk of the alcoholic in the middle of the night. Panhandling, stealing, getting whatever I can get to get what I need. Not even knowing that after a period of time, what time of the year it is, what time of the day it is. I've lost all my emotional emotions. I lost everything. I was a zombie walking on the streets. And for 19 months, I couldn't even tell you it was 19 months until my mother really reminded me of that at one point. And I walked the streets. And one day I walked into a bar because I needed money. I was going to borrow money. And there was an old timer in there, an old guy in there. And he came up to me and goes, "Hey, Jimmy, they're hiring guys like you in Newark Airport. Guys like us in Newark Airport." That's scary. Think about that. Guys like us. "Anyone flying today? Good luck." "Guys like you." And there used to be a company called People's Express, old time airline. Right? Some of you are shaking your head, you remember, right? And the job was for us guys like us is to take the luggage that's over there and hopefully get it on the plane that's over there. So I always like to segue here and let you know that if you're flying through Newark Airport in the 80s and you're still waiting for your luggage, I'll make amends later. But the truth of the matter is, so he tells me this, and I grab two guys that are like me, and the three of us, we rob a car. And we go out to Newark Airport that next day. And it was a room like this size, and we're getting a little interview. Not, here was the interview. "Can you lift up a suitcase?" Yeah, okay, that was the interview. I remember a guy asked me a few questions. I was kind of a mess. He goes, "Just go outside, and we'll call you in." I come out, and I'm sitting in a row of chairs like this. I couldn't tell you how I really felt until I landed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what I felt. And it wasn't until I opened that little blue book. And I turned to page 8 and I get Bill's story. And Bill's given his first step experience, which I believe he gives his first step experience for all of us. No words could tell the loneliness and despair I felt in a bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. I've been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. At the age of 29 years old, sitting in that chair, I could feel the wind blowing through the hole in my soul. I think drinking's a problem. When after a couple of minutes, a complete stranger sat right next to me. And after a couple of minutes, he looked at me and goes, "What's wrong with you?" Those are the kind of questions I was getting at that time. It wasn't like, "How's your 401? Or, you know, how's the kids? I mean, what's wrong with you?" And I spit my life story up on this complete stranger. And he looked at me and goes, "I have the answer for you." And I said, "What's that?" Pulled out a piece of paper. This is pre-cell phone, pre-beeper days. He put down a street. He goes, "You know where this street is?" I go, "Yeah, that's my old neighborhood." Put a number in front of that street. And then he asked me a very important question. I thought it was a very weird question, but he asked me, "Is it possible for you not to take a drink today?" And I was honest with the guy. I said, "I want to drink right now. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning." He goes, "Try not to drink. Be in front of that address at 7 o'clock tonight." And all I could tell you is, but for the grace of God, at 7 o'clock that night, I came back from that airport, I passed out somewhere, and I find myself in front of this address at 7 o'clock that night with my knees knocking, my stomach doing flips, my head talking to me like unbelievably, like, did I even meet somebody today? I was lost. I was a lost soul. I was living in that dark, dark place when all of a sudden a 1979 Chevy Impala pulled up. And that stranger was driving that car, and he had a bunch of other strangers in that car. And he pulled up to me and he rolled down that window and he said, "The most spiritual thing you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the car." They took me around the corner. It was less than 500 yards to my grammar school, that Catholic grammar school where I had all sorts of contempt towards God, towards the religion, towards the priests, the nuns, you name it. Anything of goodness I had contempt towards. And they walked me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, walking into grace doesn't feel like walking into grace. felt like I was walking into out of chaos. I didn't understand the enormity of what I was about to walk into. I didn't understand the enormity of who I was going to meet and the kindness of strangers. I didn't understand that. And I walked into that school. And I came down those gray battleship painted steps that every Catholic school in America has. I could still smell the paint in my nose. I walked past that cafeteria where I was a sixth grader, a seventh grader, eighth grader, remembering sitting in that cafeteria with every goal, aspiration, and dreams. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to be somebody. But what I didn't understand is I took that first drink and it cut my legs out from underneath me. I started to walk down to the end of the hall and I smelled coffee in the air. Now that's being very generous. Because, and this is for you old guys and you young people, I'll take your phone out, you can Google it. There used to be a thing called Sanka. Along with Tang, I think it was something that the astronauts used to drink. But for the sake of the story, it was coffee in the air. And I smelt the coffee. And all of a sudden, I met the most important person in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at that door. We call him the greeter. And that man put his hand out to me, and I grabbed that flimsy reed, and he pulled me into you. And I've been with you guys ever since. And that was on March 28, 1987. And I got involved. Thank you. I got involved very quickly, and I got involved with the home group. And on my first day, this guy, this stranger became my sponsor. That Jersey City, it was called the Jersey City Young People's Group. That became my home group. So on day one, I had a home group and I had a sponsor that took away the interview process and all that stuff. Didn't know what a sponsor or a home group was, but I apparently had one on day one. But let me tell you about the kindness of strangers. You know, there was a time back in AA in my neighborhood where we never even opened up that blue book. You know, meetings were about meetings with speaker meetings, meetings with discussion meetings. There wasn't much push onto the steps or even service at that time, really. It was about just not drinking and going to meetings, right? And so these guys, you know, and I used to goof around with them, you know, they were really old. They were like 45, you know, but, you know, but they it was a different generation. And they were already married. They had kids. They had jobs. It was just different, a little different than it is today, you know. And but these guys, you know, I used to say they wouldn't know the difference between a phone book and a big book. But these were the guys that would be on your front porch if you needed help. And one of the things that I learned very quickly was the art of the 12-step call. Because that's an art that has left basically left AA in some areas. And so it would be very common 2-3 nights a week to get a phone call from the old time sponsor saying, you know, not asking if you want to go, just downstairs 10 minutes. That was what he would say. And you know, you didn't ask 10 minutes, you were downstairs. And we get in a car, it'd be me and another young guy and two old timers, and we go to someone's house. And, you know, our job was to find out if there's any guns around or weapons or any of that other stuff, make sure the wife and the kids are safe. And then we watch the magic that all you guys have seen in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those two old guys would sit down and ante up. They tell their story to that guy. And back then, we didn't bring him to a treatment center. Rarely did we bring him to a detox unless he'd need hospitalization. We brought him to an AA meeting. And he would shake and bake in that meeting, and that's when I first started seeing guys bringing pints of whiskey in their cars. And I thought, like, that was sacrilegious. You can't do something like that. But I didn't understand why they were doing that. And that became a very, very important part of my early sobriety. And I like to tell you, I didn't get on this rocket ship and just went up, up, and away. My sobriety hasn't been like that. You know, I've grown, I hit the wall, I've grown, I hit the wall. I think that's a very common thing for most of us, right? And we have these surrenders as we go along through the years, right? So on day two, these guys, the kindness of strangers, they put me up in a motel. They went to a department store. They bought me T-shirts, sneakers, and jeans. They were really kind and considerate for what they did. I'll never forget, on day two, they pulled up to the motel to bring me to a meeting, and I shared an emotion. That's kind of strange, Jim. You shared an emotion? Yeah, because I was so shut down as a human being. I was so shut down. I couldn't talk about anything that was going on. Plus, I lived by the street code. Real men, strong men, tough guys, don't talk about the way they feel. But this guy, Richie, pulled up. I said, Richie, I want a drink, and I'm scared. You don't say I'm scared on the streets where I come from. That's a sign of weakness. And Richie said, I know you do. And this fly is killing me. And what happened that day was, you know, I saw what a trusted servant in AA does. The guy called up his wife, said, take me off the calendar. I'm with a newcomer. And that day, he took me to three meetings. He fed me three times. I drank 700 cups of coffee that day. And I felt like a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Day seven. I can remember it like it happened this morning. I'm at my new home group, my new sponsor, my new friends. I knew all these new things going on in my life. I have no idea what's going on, but I'm there. I'm in the mix. I'm in it. I'm in it. And I'm at a business meeting. Man, was I excited. A business meeting. And Richie walks up. He goes, I want you to take this job. I said, what's that job? He goes, I want you to clean the ashtrays. Ashtrays? In my mind. You got to be kidding me. Clean ashtrays? I had a legitimate reason for that. To this moment, I have never smoked a cigarette in my life. Why do I need to clean an ashtray? I didn't get it, right? I didn't get he was trying to teach me the responsibility. He was trying to teach me how to be part of a group. But what I can tell you is I said yes. Why? Because I listened to that small voice that's in every person in this room right now. That little intuitive thing that says, you know what? Trust this guy. He's trying to help you. He's not trying to hurt you. And I said yes to cleaning that ashtray. And what I can tell you is from that moment there, day seven, to this moment where I stand right now, I've been attached, tethered, hooked to Alcoholics Anonymous through a service commitment, whether it's my home group, my district, my area. I've been in the middle of the game. And I'll tell you, it's the greatest thing that happened to a guy like me because I needed you. I couldn't sit on the outskirts of this thing. I needed to be in the middle of this thing. And though, yeah, I didn't work the steps yet, and though I had a belly filled with all those emotions and all that stuff was going on in my life, I just felt part of something. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous meetings from the get-go, even though I was still screwed up. I got back with that wife I walked out on. I don't know how that happened. I bounced back physically really fast. Things started to happen in my life so rapidly, my head would spin. All of a sudden, we got two kids. I got a real job. I got a great job. You know, I had that light, that house with the white picket fence. And be careful, because I thought, you know, to the untrained eye, I thought normal living was the solution to alcoholism. But at 5 years without a drink, I got a rope. I just need a bridge to jump off. See, I'm dying in the rooms of AA. I don't know how to talk about that stuff. I'm dying from something I don't even know I'm dying from. I'm dying from this thing called untreated alcoholism. Yeah, I'm physically sober. I'm living under the delusion that abstinence is a solution to a spiritual problem. But the problem is this. I still got that belly filled with fear. I still got that belly filled with anxiety and insecurity. I still am walking around with secrets. I'm still walking around with secrets. The stuff I'm not going to talk to you about. I'm a great AA member when you say, Jimmy, how's everything going? Everything is fine as the veins in my neck are about to explode. You know? Because I don't know how to share with another person. I don't know how to sit down eyeball to eyeball. Everything, every conversation is surface. So I'm doing a talk in this town, and I'm at the podium like I am now. I'm talking on the second step. I'm lying to everyone in the meeting because I'm so paralyzed by what you think of me. I have no relationship with God. After the meeting, there was a little line. They come up, shake your hand. This guy walks up to me. I'm 6'4". He's 6'4". He looks at me. He doesn't shake my hand. He looks at me and goes, you're screwed. With a little bit salty language. And I want to start a fight in the meeting of AA because I don't know how to face resistance without resistance. I don't know how to face conflict or confrontation without conflict. I'm still violent by nature. Those things have not left me. I'm just not drinking. But I look at this guy in the face and I say, you're right. I need help. And that day, that next day, I find myself in a railroad room apartment. And this guy's giving me the spiritual test. Railroad room apartment, buildings that were built in after World War II, maybe even World War I, where all your family would come from Europe and live in the same apartment. And it was like a long hallway. And I'm in this room with this guy, and he has a Jack Russell. Anyone know what a Jack Russell is? Yeah, that's like giving a newcomer 40 cups of coffee and letting him go. That dog was running the walls. And I'm like, and I'm getting this test. First test, first question of this test. He looks at me and says, how long could you hold your breath? How long can you hold your breath? How long can you be in a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? What's your relationship with God look like? I'm Catholic. I believe in God. But what's God have to do with this? What makes you alcoholic? Best I could stammer out of my mouth in that moment was, I drank too much. No idea what I was up against. Then he asked me a question a lot of you guys might not believe, but this is the way it was in my neighborhood. He looked at me and said, where's your big book? And I looked at him and I said, what's a big book? Now, I'm sure there was a big book on a table, at a literature table. We were never encouraged to open up a big book. And then he looked at me and goes, Jimmy, if AA works, why do you have so many problems? Because the truth of the matter is, I'm not working AA. Yeah, I'm sitting in a chair and I'm drinking your coffee and I'm talking with the guys and I'm looking at the girls and I'm doing all the things we do and it means AA. But I'm really not doing anything in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not recovering from anything. I'm just abstinent. I'm just not drinking. And what happened that day was I sat down with this guy called Bill Grace. He comes from St. Paul, Minnesota, the same place that my sponsor comes from today, ironically. And he was a guy that walked in my town with a blue book under his arm. He was on with the facts about himself, and he had a message of depth and weight. And he sat me down, and we started to talk about what the real goal of Alcoholics Anonymous is. He said, Jim, this is my opinion. It could be your opinion. It is my opinion today. There's only two goals, really, in AA. First goal is the obvious one. Don't pick up the first drink. But the second goal is the goal we all want to attain, and that's to step into the sunlight of the Spirit, to have a spiritual experience, to have a relationship with God, to get to that place where we could just unburden ourselves of ourselves, to get to a place of freedom, to get to a place where the bondage of self gets removed. We start to have true partnerships with God and with each other. As the old timers used to say, Jim, alcoholism is nothing more than a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and a disconnect from each other. I've been walking around my life with walls built around me, with no one's coming in, and I'm not coming out. My sponsor talks about driving, living life like living in a tank. You know, you got that tank, and you got that little window right in that tank, and that's how most of us are living life, just with one perception, no open-mindedness towards anything, and that's what I was doing. Sober and stuck in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat with Bill Grace. He told me that if I want to get free, I got to walk into the darkness of my life. I have to walk. If I want to be free, I got to walk into the darkness of my life. And I read this all the time because this is one of the most important things I've ever read. It comes out of Daily Reflections. Go to May 1st, second paragraph. It's the side of myself that I refuse to look at that rules me. I must be willing to look at the dark side in order to heal my mind and my heart, because that's the road to freedom. I must walk into darkness to find the light and interfere to find peace. I got to go in. I had to go in. As the old timers used to say, AA is nothing more than a bonfire. A lot of people are walking around that fire. They're staying warm, but eventually that fire is going to go out. If you really want to change, if you really want to grow, you got to walk through that fire and get your ass burnt and feel the uncomfortability of change. And thank God I was willing on this day to walk through the fire, because there's one thing I can't do for anyone in this room and you guys can't do for me, and that's give you willingness. Willingness is an inside job, and the only way willingness has happened is through a good whooped ass. And I was whooped, and I needed help. And this gentleman started to walk me through the process of the 12 steps, and I started to walk into that hallway of life. And I started to uncover, discover, and discard the things that were blocking me from God and blocking me from you. And I started to do that stuff that we do in the steps, you know. I started to understand the first step, this allergy, this thing called the doctor's opinion. I started to read that. I live right by Silkworth's grave in New Jersey. We're there all the time whenever we have conferences. I pass that cemetery on a regular basis. And let me tell you something. I look in that cemetery, and who do I see there all the time? You guys. Whether you have a beach chair or whether you have a folding chair, you're sitting in front of his gravesite, and I know what you're doing. One drunk helping another. The basic service of Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk sharing experience, strength, and hope with another one, hopefully to get that person free like that person is today. And that's what started to happen to me. I walked into that darkness. I started to look at these things. I started to get down to the common manifestations of living my life on self-will. I started to look at the rage that was inside me, the fire, the hundreds of forms of fear, the harms I caused. I remember I was homeless 1 year. And I walked into a bar, and I saw my sister in that bar. And I walked up to my sister, and she looked at me and said, "Who are you?" "I'm your brother." She almost fainted. She was 22 years old. "We don't think we're hurting anyone here?" She almost fainted. It was the most painful amends I ever had, one of the most painful amends I ever had to make. So I had to look at this stuff. I had to look at the unhealthy dependencies I have, the unhealthy dependencies I put on a partner or a woman to make you make me feel okay. The unexpected, I had to look at these unreal expectations of living a life I was living. I had to get down to causes and conditions of the things that not only make me alcoholic, but the things that block me from you. And as I wrote that inventory and I shared it with my sponsor, I had the most powerful experience ever, my original fifth step. I've done many fifth steps since, but this was the doozy of all doozies, my first one. And I was in for a long talk. I gave this guy everything, because what I was very clear about was this, that I'll never be a free man. I'll never step into the sunlight of the Spirit with a secret in my back pocket. that I have to put it all on the table. I got to show my cards. I got to ante up. I got to do all those things because if I want to be free, that was the only thing I had to do. I had to be willing to put my neck out there and not be worried about being judged, being criticized, being anything. But one of the good news is I was sitting across from one of us. And when I sat with that man and I had that long talk, I took that hour, like it says, take that hour, and I went to a place called Liberty State Park, which is on the Hudson River overlooking Manhattan. And I walked out on this pier, and I sat down, and I opened up the book, and I read that that last paragraph on page 75. I read those five proposals, all the stones properly in place. You guys know the questions. And then I looked to my right. And less than a quarter of a mile to my right was the Statue of Liberty. I looked across the river, and back then, the World Trade Center was still there. I looked to my left, and I could see Ellis Island, symbols of freedom. Symbols of freedom in my mind, and here I sat as a 32-year-old man with tears coming down my eyes, with the arms of God wrapped around me, and I knew for the first time in my life I was going to be okay. I let go of the secrets. I let another person in. I started to walk through the darkness, and I started to get free. And yeah, like I said, I fell for one of the biggest traps you could ever fall for, working the steps. I fell prey to comfortability. Because at this point, my sobriety, everything started to get good. The family, we got the AA babies, we had, the nice house, all this stuff. And like I share it all the time, sometimes we're the last ones to see the drift. Sometimes we're the last ones to see that we're off the beam. I live on the ocean. If I take the boat out on the ocean, I point it east, I can see the horizon, I can see the sunset. It's absolutely gorgeous where I live. But what I don't see is what I'm not looking at behind me, and that's the drift from one town to one town to one town. And by the time I'm 10 years sober, I've drifted again. I've fallen off the mark. I'm having problems at home. I'm having problems on a job. I'm having problems in life. And I have a solution that I think is a good one, but really it's the lie that we tell ourselves, the chattering of 1,000 monkeys in my head. That this is the answer. So I fall into the arms of a woman in AA who knows, who could help. And I blow my life up at 10 years sobriety. I'm the guy that builds a beautiful spiritual structure up for me and my family, and I tear it down with a senseless series of sprees. Let me tell you something. You don't need to blow up your life. You don't need to be drinking to blow up your life in AA. Just sponsor a bunch of guys. You'll find that out. But I blow up my life, and by the time I'm 13 years sober, I'm lying to everyone again. I'm the guy in the fifth step about the double life. I'm living that double life all over again. And I'm trying to justify that life. And I walk in a bar because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired of 13 years. And I go to the bartender, give me a drink. And I understand what Dr. Bob was talking about when he says he was stuck between a rock and a hard place because his bartender put that drink on that bar. I didn't want to take that drink, but I needed that drink so bad to stop the pain. And the devil and the angel pop out, drink it, don't drink it, drink it, don't drink it. When all of a sudden a hand goes around it and pulls it back. And the bartender just happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you doing today, Jim? Apparently throwing my life away. I take my tail, I put it between my legs, and I walk out. And I don't have the time to go through a whole bunch of stuff, but I met a man that started to help me, and I got back on my feet, and I started to go through the steps again, and I started to look at a lot of the stuff that was just pulling me down, the old ideas, the ideas and emotions and attitudes, the guiding forces of our lives. I had to take an examination. I had to peel the onion a lot deeper. I had to get deeper with this spiritual life. I had to let you in deeper. I had to start being honest with myself and with others. And then all the adversities of life. We all have adversities in this room. We've had a couple of weeks, a couple of months, really, that's been a nightmare lately. I had major dental surgery, unexpected. I just had shoulder surgery. My wife just had knee surgery. 6 weeks ago, I got contracted some autoimmune disease. The cause of it now, I got vitiligo. If anyone's familiar with that, I've lost all pigmentation in my head, my face, my neck. Like, why me? Why me, God? Why me, my... And I went through a depression, but guess what? It's not going to kill me, and I'm here today. And I'm grateful for this, to have doctors in my life to take care of me. Thank you. And it seems so minor, you know, I've been through, you know, in 1999, I was in a horrific accident on the job. I worked for a highway authority, and I got retired on December 6, 1999. I've had 41 surgeries since that day. I've had 12 back, 3 knee replacements. Be honest with you, I'm 5'8", but with all the metal in me, I'm 6'4". It's a miracle. You know? And then my mom dying. My mom was 90 years old. The doctor came to her and said, "Hey, your mom needs a knee replacement." We're like, "What are you, out of your mind?" My mom was a Jane Fonda workout freak, right? And she worked out every day till 88, and she needed a new knee. So get a new knee. He goes, "There's nothing wrong with her. She had 5 kids. That's the only time she'd been in a house." So she had the knee done, and all of a sudden, you know, because when you go on the when you go on anesthesia that late in life, you know, you get dementia, and she went off the rails real fast. And me and my wife and my sisters and brothers, we became the parent of my parent. My dad died when I was 18 months sober. I walked in the house, I was 18 months sober, and I find my father dead on the floor. And I'm programmed now. Call the sponsor, call him up. What do I do? Let's pray, call 911. So we're praying, first cop shows up. First cop is standing there, he's taking information down. He looks at me, he goes, "I don't see you walking the streets anymore." I said, "Yeah, I don't do that." He goes, "I don't see you drinking in any of the bars." "Yeah, I don't do that either." And what happened in the next 15, 20 minutes is I 12-stepped this cop over my dead father's body. And I tell you that because about 6 months ago in my home group, I get a tap on my shoulder, I turn around, it was the cop who's now retired to let me know that he just celebrated 34 years of sobriety. And I don't say that for a clap. I just say God will use you without your permission in the darkest of times. Because one of the things I found out is one of the greatest spiritual truths we have in the rooms of AA is that in order to get out of the darkness of my life, I need to start serving others. And that's what our 12-step is all about. So my mom comes in and lives with us. We can't handle her. We put her in assisted living. And COVID hits. And the whole joint gets COVID. And my mom gets COVID. And my mom passes away with COVID. 94 years old, and I just had my third knee replacement. The hospice nurse calls me and said, "Come, she's going to die any minute. You want to talk to her?" And I get there and cut the story a little short. You know, she can't hear you. I mean, she can't see you. She can't talk to you. But she could hear you. And then I had that moment. I had that moment that I've heard from a million podiums. I've heard that moment from all you guys who have dealt with adversities in your life. I walked in there and I sat with my mom. And when I walked in there, what I saw was a skeleton laying in a bed. But I had that moment. And I grabbed her hand and I started to talk about us. Started to talk about our life. There was a time when my mother, at 90 years old, looked at me and my wife, Mary Beth, and said to me, "I couldn't find you for 2 years. I walked the streets looking for my son. Where were you? How do you make amends on that?" But here I sat with my mom. And the minute I left, about an hour later, she passed away. I'm so grateful that God called me to be the son, to be there, to talk to her, to walk her through that period of time. I'm so grateful for that. And I'll just wrap this up. I know Jimmy has to get to a plane, but if he misses it, well, there's always People's Express, you know? There's somewhere around the United States. Anyway, I'll end this real quick because I know that I have to go and we want to wrap this up and you guys want to get... I got to go home. 9 hours ride. We started a group on the Jersey Shore 18 years ago. We needed a GSR. They said, "Jimmy, why don't you be the GSR?" I don't want to be the GSR. I hate service. I'm 19 years sober. I'm too good for that stuff. I have no idea. There's nobody doing service in where I grew up. There was only two guys, young timers. You could open up your phone and Google these two names, but there was two cops in my town. One guy's name was Jackie Gleason and his sponsor was Mickey Rooney. They were the only guys I knew. So I never got involved, you know, and I went to this thing, you know, I said, I'll reluctantly put my hand, I became a GSR, and all of a sudden, you know, I go to this thing called Narasser. At that time, it was in Hunt Valley, Maryland. I go down there, I'm terrified, 19 months, I don't know nothing, right? And I go in there, and I meet these two old-timers from my neighborhood. I thought they were, you know, just two old-timers from my neighborhood. One was the United States trustee at large, and the other one was the Northeast Regional Trustee. They were both passed, you know, they were passed. So, you know, they brought me under their wing. They give me a service manual. I never read a service manual. They said, "Hey, read page S20 in the old manual. You know, Bernard Smith, why do we have a conference, you know? Bill Wilson's lawyer, you know, talking about why we have a conference, why we do the things in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not to ensure our own sobriety. We're here today. I know people know what to do when they show up at their home group. I know what you guys know what to do when a newcomer comes to your front door. But right now, I could tell you right now, in Carabasset, Maine, there's someone right now that just cracked open his first beer of the day, not knowing that there's 700 people from Maine in this room right now that have a solution to his problem. Right now in Carabasset, Maine, there's a single mom with three kids who can't wait to put those kids down so she could have her first drink of the day and just wash her day away. Right now, where I stand to where I live in New Jersey, to Jimmy's house in Dallas, and every hospital in between, there's a baby being born destined for alcoholism. So what I started to understand is I have a responsibility. I need to do more. I need to get in this thing more. I need to carry this message to the alcoholic still suffers who doesn't know we're in here right now. So I started to get involved in this service like I never did before. And I went down that inverted triangle. I became a DCM. I became the area chair. I became an alternate delegate. I just rotated out last year as the delegate to the panel 71 delegate. I served with Nikki. I served with Peter, who's not here. I served with Sue, who's an alternate from New Hampshire. Francis, who's a Northeast Regional Trustee. Jimmy Dean, there's so many people here I served with. The bright spot of my life. And I'll end with this. My first year as delegate, I had a it was virtual. My second year was in person. I'm the closest delegate out of the 93 delegates to Brooklyn. And I drove to Brooklyn in my car, my truck, while everyone else flew in. And when I was going to Brooklyn, I said to myself, let me go in my old neighborhood, the town I grew up in, right across the river. And I drove through that town. And I drove through those streets that I would walk aimlessly at night, not knowing who I was and where I was and who you were. I drove past that house that I grew up in, where the violence would go on, the yelling, the screaming, the drinking. I drove past that bar, that first bar that I walked in as a 15, 16-year-old kid and got my first drink in a bar. Everything seemed so small, and I had tears in my eyes. I was so grateful for the life that gave me. The old timers used to give us two promises, and the first one was this. Young people, new people, if you come all the way in and sit all the way down, you're going to have lifelong relationships and friendships you never knew that existed. I'm in a room with all friends that I don't even know. I've met people all over the United States. And the other thing that they promised me was this. In New Jersey, we don't do the CHIP system like some of the states do. We do a 90-day pinning and a yearly pinning. And a 90-day pin was an old pin that they had. It was a gold triangle with a dot in the middle with a G on top and an AA on the bottom. And what would happen on your 90-day celebration was you'd walk to a podium, you always had a jacket and tie on because the old-time AAs taught you etiquette to respect Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what, no matter how you feel, suit up, show up. And you would stand at the podium, they would hold that pin, and they'd point to that little insignificant dot and say, that's you, Jimmy, the little insignificant dot. But here's the promise they made me and the promise I'm making you right now. If you put one hand in G, one hand in God, and one hand in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and get involved in the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, of recovery, unity, and service, I guarantee you won't have a hand to pick up a drink. That's all I have. Thank you.